Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I just want to thank you all for coming tonight, and always thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and all the other independent bookstores. We're very excited tonight to have Benjamin Hale here with his new book, The Evolution of Bruno Littlemore. As many of you here tonight know, Benjamin Hale grew up right here in Colorado. He now lives in New York. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and he received a Provost Fellowship. He went on to win the prestigious Michener Copernicus Award. Besides the wide acclaim Benjamin has received for The Evolution of Bruno Littlemore, he has additional talents and has worked as a technical writer, an illustrator, a cartoonist, and a pizza deliverer. Will you please join me in giving a warm welcome to Benjamin Hale?
Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you very much for having me here at the Tattered Cover. Well, I guess what I'm going to do is just begin by reading a little bit from the book, probably about 20 minutes or so, and then just do a Q&A. So this book is narrated by a talking chimpanzee, and that's pretty much all the exposition I think I need to give. I'm going to read the first paragraph and then the second chapter and a little bit of another part later on. My name is Bruno Littlemore. Bruno I was given, Littlemore I gave myself, and with some prodding I have finally decided to give this undeserving and spiritually diseased world the generous gift of my memoirs. I give this gift with the aim and hope that they will enlighten, enchant, forewarn, instruct, and perchance even entertain. However, I find the physical tedium of actually writing unendurable. I never bothered learning to type any more adroitly than by use of the embarrassingly primitive hunt-and-peck method. And as for pen and paper, my hands are awkwardly shaped and tire easily of etching out so many small, fastidious markings. That is why I have elected to deliver my memoirs by dictation. And because voice recorders detest me for the usual reasons, I must have an amanuensis. Right now, it is 11:15 in the morning, on a drably nondescript day in September. I am lying partially supine and extremely comfortably on a couch, my shoes off but my socks on, a glass of iced tea tinkling peacefully in my hand, and there is a soft-spoken young woman named Gwen Gupta sitting in this very room with me, recording my words in a yellow notepad with a pencil and a laser-like sense of concentration. Gwen, my amanuensis, is a college student employed as an intern at the research center where I am housed. It is she who acts as midwife to these words which my mind conceives and my lungs and tongue bear forth, delivering them from my mouth and by the sheer process of documentation imbuing them with the solemnity and permanence of literature. Now to begin. Where should I begin, Gwen? No, don't speak. I'll begin with the first time I met Lydia, because Lydia is the reason why I am here. Skipping to the second chapter. The first time I met Lydia, I was so young and uncontaminated by the world that I did not even know I was participating in a scientific experiment. I was brought into this strange blank white room. Everyone's shoes squeaked on the hard, shiny floor, and the high-frequency buzzing of fluorescent lights overhead made me jittery and discombobulated. The three of us, I, Bruno, my idiot brother, Cookie, and little Celeste, were let out of the cage in which they had conveyed us to this alien room, to allow us a little time to acclimate ourselves to these surroundings at our leisure, to accustom our eyes to the stinging brightness, to meet the scientists. That's when I met Lydia. She bent to the floor and held her arms open for me, and I ran to her and climbed into them. And for the rest of the day, that was where I stayed, cradled in her arms, breathing her fantastic scent that I even then must have found erotic, except when she was too busy with her work, or when they ripped us apart so that they could run their moronic experiments on me. I suppose I shouldn't say moronic, because that experiment was what marked me as different right from the beginning. Of course, I had no idea what was going on at the time. I had not yet acquired language, so I couldn't have articulated my thoughts. That, by the way, is the ironic thing about acquiring language relatively late in life. Words don't exist to adequately describe what it's like when that tempest of wordless thoughts whirling around in your head suddenly snaps to definition. That great hop from the prelinguistic to the linguistic is squarely in the realm of the ineffable. As far as I knew, all that was going on was this. I was taken into a small, empty white room with a long, rectangular reflective panel embedded in one wall. I now realized this was a one-way mirror, behind which another scientist was probably watching me like a voyeur with an eye to the keyhole. The scientist who had conducted me into the room was not the woman whom I would later come to know as Lydia. Was that you, watching me from behind the mirror, Lydia, but some droll old fat-bearded sot who held no especial interest for me? There was a transparent plastic box on the floor. The scientist produced from the pocket of his white coat, with the excessively theatrical flourish of an amateur magician, a peach. A peach, Gwyn. He was my serpent, and I was his Eve. There we were, me in my prelapsarian nudity, and he in his demonic white coat, tempting me with fruit coveted but prohibited. The only difference was environmental. We'd swapped sexy Edenic lushness for the sterile whitewashed walls of science. Also, that particular fruit is semiotically associated with the female pudenda, isn't it? Isn't that way Cezanne painted them? Still life with peaches? Why, that's just a quivering bowlful of vulva sweating on the breakfast table, waiting for you to eat them up. But the peach in question. So he takes, the scientist does, he takes a juicy piggish bite out of it and starts making yummy yum yum noises. Rubbing his belly, trying to goad my jealousy, you see. And, as I recall, it worked. I was a simpler creature then. I remember wanting the peach at that moment more than anything. Hell, I would have sold my soul for a peach, and in a way I did, didn't I? I remember hating, no, loathing that smug, old, fat, imperious bastard for the way he lorded the fruit over me so. So he took his bite, breaking the skin, releasing into the room the ambrosial aroma of that sticky, wet, fleshy treat, and then he, bastard, pushed me out of the way when I reached for it. Then, turning to the box, transparent plastic box on the floor, remember? He operated some sort of device that made the lid of the box spring open, placed the peach inside, and shut the lid. I was watching his actions with curiosity and a motley of deadly sins, greed, envy, gluttony, lust. Then, the demonstration. The box opening mechanism consisted of a button and a lever. He pressed the button, then he rapped on the lid of the box 3 times with his knuckles, like this. Then he flipped the lever and the lid of the box popped open. He reached in and, again, moving his arms in such a grossly histrionic manner, it was as if he wanted the people in the nosebleed seats to see what he was doing and making a face like, "Look, Bruno, what do we have here?" He extracted the peach. Again, I reached for it. Again, he pushed me away. Then he put the peach back in the box, promptly left the room, and pulled the door shut behind him. Bruno was alone. Alone with the box, with the peach clearly visible but locked away inside, forbidden to Bruno. I looked at it a moment. I pressed the button. I knocked 3 times on the lid, flipped the lever, opened the box, and removed the peach. Did I dare to eat a peach? Indeed I did. In this way, I fell from my state of innocence. The door opened, I was escorted out, and my brother Cookie in, where I understand the same procedure was repeated on him. A little while later, all 3 of us, Cookie, Celeste, and I, had made it through the first round, and I was taken back into the room until they decided enough time had elapsed to renew my appetite. Only this time it was Lydia, gorgeous-smelling Lydia, my human peach, who attended me into the little room with the box. Just being alone in a room with that woman was enough. And now she removed a peach from the pocket of her white coat. She took a sopping wet bite out of it and took her sweet time chewing. Then she placed the peach inside the box, waited a moment, pressed the button, knocked her knuckles on the lid of the box 3 times, click, 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 flipped the lever that opened the box, and retrieved the peach. After locking it up again, she left the room, though I entreated her to stay. Alone, I again, in turn, pressed pressed the button, tap, tap, tapped, flipped the lever, and proceeded to feast. But this peach tasted so much richer than the first, as it was imbued with the magic of her touch, with her lips, no less, her tongue. I had seen that woman put her mouth on this object. The vicarious contact made me insane with desire. I would have preferred her to chew the peach to a pulp and sensuously ooze it intermingled with her own fluids into my mouth. I ate every shred of the thing, every last ort and fiber and dribble of nectar, and then sucked on the stone for an hour after and became enraged when the other scientists tried to take it from me. I kept it securely in the pocket of my cheek and would under no circumstances relinquish it until, yes, Lydia herself coaxed me to surrender it by holding her hand to my mouth, and finally I willingly spat the stone, slick with my saliva, into the cup of her pretty hand. Anyway, this bizarre, and to me at the time, unfathomable procedure. It was repeated again and again all day until it looked like we'd all had our fill of their fucking peaches. Much later, Dr. Lydia Littlemore would explain to me why my performance on that day had marked me as extraordinary. In retrospect, I understand now what I could only feel at the time. As I've said, I did not yet have language. This is not to say that I did not have a consciousness in those days, or that I did not have thoughts. I certainly did. But I had none of these traps in which to capture and keep them, words. Back then, my thoughts could only trickle through my head in a liquid state. Trying to think clearly was like trying to drink water out of cupped hands. Most of it dribbles through your fingers before you've really had a chance to drink, and you remain thirsty still, thirsty and ignorant. When my consciousness was solidified enough to understand, Lydia told me that I had participated in a psychological experiment they were running on two groups, human infants and free adolescent chimpanzees. The experiment goes like this. You have this transparent plexiglass box with a door that can be opened by a mechanism requiring a two-step process to unlatch. Press the button and flip the lever. You place inside the box something the infant or chimpanzee is supposed to want, in my case a peach. And this, in my opinion, is the most problematic aspect of the experiment. What complex being will always want a peach? Suppose I wasn't hungry. Am I supposed to be a creature of such brainlessly insatiate appetite that given the opportunity I would cram every last peach on the planet into my ravenous maw? Later in my life, when I was sitting in on an introductory course in microeconomics at the University of Chicago, I realized that economists tend to think about their fellow sapiens in exactly these terms. Rational choice theory, so they call it. Homo economicus. Fools! The thing that defines us rational creatures, like you and me, Gwen, is precisely the fact that we're not always rational. But I digress. So you put the peach in the box, and then demonstrate to the subject how to open it. The scientist presses the button, taps three times on the lid of the box, and flips the lever. Then leave the test subject alone and watch what he does. Then repeat this procedure ad nauseum on the largest test sampling you can get. The objective of the experiment is to see whether the human or ape child figures out that the tapping on the box bit is an unnecessary step. Their typically anthropo-chauvinist hypothesis was that all your innately superior little human snots would quit tapping on the stupid box before the chimps. And the results were exactly the opposite of their predictions. All but one of the chimps, and they tested more than 50 of us and as many human infants, quickly figured out that the tapping shtick was a superfluous waste of time, and thus aborted the measure from the box opening procedure on the second or third trial run. A few of the chimpanzee subjects, my older brother, Cookie, among them, and this sort of behavior is characteristic of him, on the third trial run got the box open simply by picking it up and smashing against a wall. The humans, though. The human babies would faithfully tap on the box every time. Everyone, every time. Now, Gwen, what do you think this means? I'll tell you. It means this. For the human test subjects, the whole thing was less about the reward than it was about the process. You see, it wasn't so much that they wanted the peach as to participate in this enigmatic ritual, to perform the rite, to say their prayers. Because it's you humans who have your absurdities of faith, your superstitions, your banshees and hobgoblins, your necromancies and haruspices, your charms and potions and voodoo dolls and magic mirrors and boogeymen, you who infantilize the universe by vainly searching for celestial answers to earthly questions and the movement of the stars, you who have your signs and symbols, your signifiers and signifieds, you who cast a terror-stricken backward glance into the darkness and ask yourselves, who is that third who walks always beside you? You who chant your incantations, kiss the ring and cross yourselves, sear images into your flesh, and poke holes in yourselves, hack off parts of your bodies and paint yourselves blue, burn witches and sacrifice your firstborns, scream into the whirlwind and wrestle with the angels to the break of dawn. And they thought we would be the ones to continue squandering a few precious seconds that stood between us and those delicious peaches by tapping on the box, even when the action obviously affected no empirical change upon the object? Absurd! It is only rubbing on the lamp. It is only magic. It is only religion. It is only the shadow of the hand of God. It is only one more example illustrating how feebly you people know yourselves. Anyway, point being, who is the one and only chimpanzee among the hundred-some-plus sampling of members of my own birth species, Pan Troglodytes, who, like the human children, never cease to tap on the box? That's right, c'est moi. I, Bruno, somehow understood on some fundamental level, as Lydia realized in hindsight after the experiment was over and the unexpected results had been properly tabulated, scrutinized, and pondered over until they succeeded in twisting some anthropo-chauvinist take out of the data, what it means to be human. And Lydia remembered me. Me, Bruno, the chimpanzee who had fallen in love with her. And she sought me out and found me and began to bring me out of my animal darkness. Okay. I'm going to read one more small part that is going to take me a second to find. This is a part from about 100 pages further into it, where he is introduced to a puppet named, Punch, like Punch and Judy, and he's freaked out by the puppets. But afterwards, this is his reflection on puppets. The next time I was watching my beloved Bert and Ernie on Sesame Street, Lydia may have pointed out to me that even they were puppets of a certain sort, that these benign figures whom I loved were puppets too, and I didn't find them frightening, did I? True as that may have been, a key difference with Bert and Ernie was that the puppeteers of Sesame Street took pains to mask the human agency and artifice behind them. As long as the viewer is fooled, it doesn't matter what they are. I was perfectly willing to believe that Bert and Ernie were real. I was willing to invest all my conviction in them, that they were autonomous, sentient beings, not artificial things designed to mimic the look of actual organisms, given movement to mimic life, and given voices to mimic conscious intelligence. Puppets are frightening only when the artifice is noticeable. It was also pointed out to me that one of my favorite films at the time, and still, Pinocchio, concerned a puppet. That did not lend me any reassurance either. For one thing, Pinocchio is clearly not set in a universe that obeys our own conceptions of reality. This is evident right from the beginning of the film. The film opens with the lonely old puppet maker and clockmaker, Geppetto, fashioning Pinocchio from a block of wood and painting him. When he completes the project, Geppetto dances the puppet, a marionette, around his home, to the general vexation of his two pets, a kitten named Figaro and a fish named Cleo. Before retiring for the evening, the childlike old man happens to look out of his bedroom window and notices that a new star has messianically appeared in the firmament. He wishes upon it, wishing that the puppet he has just made, Pinocchio, were a real boy. While he sleeps, the star becomes a beautiful semi-translucent woman who floats into the room through the window and, with a touch of her magic wand, animates Pinocchio. Pinocchio slowly blinks his wooden eyelids and stirs his wooden limbs, and, the strings attached to his head, arms, and legs having vanished, comes to life. Pinocchio arrives in the world already knowing language, but with an otherwise only partially formed consciousness. He is conscious, but without conscience, knowing nothing of the norms or moral conventions of the civilization into which he has just been born. For this purpose, the Blue Fairy employs Jiminy, an anthropomorphic cricket drifter who happens to have earlier broken into Geppetto's home unnoticed to seek shelter inside one of the room's many clocks. The cricket finds the fairy sexually attractive. It's true. If you watch Pinocchio, the only reason he consents is because he like has a crush on the fairy. Jiminy, who obliges the fairy partly out of his attraction to her, is given a suit of fancy new clothes and employment as Pinocchio's moral tutor. The fairy tells Pinocchio that he will be made into a real boy if he completes a sort of moral trial period as a living puppet. With this, the fairy retreats back through the window and goes back to being a star. Just then, Geppetto wakes up. At first, he is astonished that his wish has come true and the puppet has come alive, indicating that this is an unexpected event, but he surprisingly quickly readjusts his understanding of reality and soon has accepted that Pinocchio was alive. The very next morning, Geppetto decides that Pinocchio must go to school. He gives him a textbook and an apple to give to his teacher, and with no clear direction, sends him on his way. However, Pinocchio is waylaid by an evil fox and a cat, both wearing clothes and anthropomorphic, who convince him to pursue a career in the theater. Pinocchio's naivete causes him to easily fall victim to their chicaneries, and the fox and the cat sell him into a life of indentured servitude to a brutal puppeteer named Stromboli. Throughout the story, Pinocchio's greatest vulnerability is his blindly trusting naivete. Many adventures follow, and Pinocchio, after repeated errors of judgment and understanding, is finally reunited with Geppetto. At the end of the film, he is rewarded with becoming a biological human child. The fox and the cat, however, seem perfectly at ease in the human sphere of activity, communicating with and even engaging in economic transactions with humans, who never find it at all strange that they are animals. Clearly, this is a universe in which Pinocchio's quest to become a real boy is absurd. He is already anthropomorphic. What else does he want? This is a universe in which some animals are merely animals, such as Geppetto's pet cat, Figaro, and other animals have been given the pass of full human consciousness with which to enter into the dealings of ordinary human civilization. I have often wondered what would have become of Pinocchio had he chosen not to become a real boy, but rather to defiantly remain forever a puppet. When he becomes a real boy, his new human flesh grows smooth over his knobby wooden joints, and his eyes suddenly glisten with authentic moisture. He has become fully human, but at what price? Now that he has traded his wooden body for an organic body of electricity, bone, blood, and water, he will presumably now grow into a man who will eventually die. Does Pinocchio realize that he has traded a state of emotionally immature immortality for the mere right to call himself a human being, even though this is a world in which such a right matters little in the course of everyday business? Surely no right-thinking consciousness would swap gold for bronze like that. He's only let himself get cheated one more time. Later, Pinocchio, the real man, will have to come to terms with the full implications of his humanity, wisdom, and acceptance of death, in order to realize that he doomed himself with the final mistake he committed in his pre-human puppethood. I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.